Reading from Sri Bhajan Rahasyam by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Discussing the fourth verse of Shikshastakam, which delineates the features and aspects of Ruchi Bhajan, or taste in devotional service. And yesterday we were describing different points. One was why Ruchi or taste is not coming. And we cited the analogy of Vishnu Chakravarti about jaundice. If we have jaundice, then we eat sugar candy, but we don't taste the sweetness. So if we have ignorance is still in us, we chant Hare Krishna due to ignorance, avidya, and aparad. Although we're chanting or taking the sugar candy, it doesn't taste sweet. And the remedy is not to stop chanting, but to chant more, as is the remedy or the cure for jaundice is to eat more sugar. And then we talked about the experience of one in Ruchi, that if one actually has Ruchi, he can chant this shloka with great conviction and realization. He's actually convinced that there's no taste in this material world. Nadanana janana sundaram kavitam va jagadisha kamye mama janmani janmani ishvare bhavatat bhaktir hoituki toyi. He realizes it. He says, yes, I am tasting it. I am there. Are you there? Yes, I'm there. Someone may ask, have you tasted it? What does it taste like? Oh, it's really good. Try some. So Mahaprabhu is offering everyone the taste. In fact, in order to get the taste, we have to beg Nityananda and Mahaprabhu to allow us to taste, because they are the connoisseurs. Nityayangor are the connoisseurs of the holy name. And they are serving various gourmet preparations of the holy name, Nam Bhajan. So by their mercy, we can get some taste. In Bhajan Rahasya, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he cites different verses to further describe what is his taste? What does it look like? What is the experience? And so he puts those in his chapter, in the fourth chapter, in relation to Nam Bhajan. So we can consider those, because these are some of the symptoms of Ruchi. That when one has taste for the name, or you can say these are also inducements to increase our chanting, because we can attain these wonderful benefits also when we have Ruchi and Nam. This is a verse from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, first division, second wave, 114th verse. His title is Peaceful. One is peaceful in loss or scarcity. Peaceful and detached. One should not be disturbed by the loss of acquired assets. Alabdeva vinashteva bhakshyach chandana sarane aviklava matir bhutva harimeva diya smarit. One who is devoted to Hari Bhakti should remain undisturbed and continue to remember Hari, even if he is unsuccessful in obtaining food or clothing, or if what he has obtained is lost. And in purport, when a living entity attains taste, ruchi, for Bhagavad Katha and Harinam, he no longer has an attachment to worldly things. He's satisfied with only the cloth and food necessary to protect and sustain the body. If he gains or loses anything, his mind remains steady. His mood is that whatever is obtained or lost is the Lord's desire. He knows that gain, loss, and so forth come according to one's previous karma. Detached from worldly matters, he remembers Sri Bhagavan's name with a steady mind. So this is giving some the kind of peaceful nature that one, which we are also discussing about over the last 2 days, the peace in the mind of a devotee, how it's permanent and deep, whereas the peace in the mind of a yogi or a jnani is subject to change due to the fluctuation of the modes of nature. Modes of nature are always in flux. You see, how is it possible? A devotee, if someone becomes a devotee, and they, like some lady, she becomes a widow, Of course, that's a social consideration. But some ladies, they become devotees at a young age, and they don't want to marry or get involved with anything but Krishna. So then they put on white. They wear white like a widow, even though they're young. I knew one Bengali lady in Sevakunj. She was our neighbor. She lived across from Damodar Mandir. And she would come every day for darshan, do parikrama at the temple. And I would take notice of her sometimes when I was taking darshan, because she would just stand there and look at Damodar, and so many tears would stream down her face, and she was whispering something, some prayers, something. And she was totally locked in her vision of Damodar. And even though I was within her peripheral vision, trying to look at her without being seen, she was just locked in, and she would go every day around. She was a very young lady, long black hair. She's like in her 25, 30, and she's still there. She was the first disciple of Srila Narayan Maharaj. Of course, he wasn't initiating initially, officially wasn't initiating, but he had initiated her. And she was wearing white, and every day wearing white. And it's quite unusual for a young lady to be satisfied with wearing one color every day, or even a young man. Men also like to dress fashionably. But they become a devotee, and they think, even sometimes people ask us, don't you get tired of wearing that same, every day, the same old color? The same old, pink or orange or whatever it is, or white. You wear that white sari and that white veil on your head every day. Don't you get bored with it? Don't you want to change, wear red, pink, yellow, this, that, the other thing? And then we say, I don't think about it. I even think about putting any clothes on at all. But just to, so no one else gets excited or disturbed, I throw some cloth over my back and I go about my business. So this is, the devotee becomes unconcerned. And even a devotee may have been very concerned beforehand. Before his consciousness changed, his mind would be so agitated with the impetus for change. Oh, I wore this red shirt yesterday. I can't wear this red shirt again today. I have to wear a blue shirt. It's impossible to wear the same color 2 days in a row. This is like a maha aparad in the clothing line, So this is kind of so many wonderful things come from this change of consciousness. As Bhaktivinoda was saying from this verse, from Hari Bhakti, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, if he's unsuccessful in obtaining food and clothing, he doesn't care. He's so devoted. One is devoted to Hari Bhakti. So this is one of the symptoms of ruchi. When one has ruchi, not only doesn't care about wealth and friends and followers or other people, he even becomes unconcerned about his own body, which is so near to him. Wealth and friends and relatives and women and men and other people, they may be somewhat removed from him or somewhat distant because they fall into the social circle of his existence. But when we talk about the very core of his life, his skin that covers his body and his own belly, he even becomes unconcerned about that. That's the stage of ruchi. I wear anything, I pick up any cloth. This is kind of the mood in the Brahmacharya Ashram. I remember in the beginning days there was community clothes. It was just a big box full of kurtas and a big box full of dhotis. And then when I joined, we didn't have like separated clothes. I mean, they would just, you just throw everything in a big box and you just grab one shirt. And sometimes it's too big or too small. And the dhotis were one size, they fit everybody. But the shirts were like this. And then after a few years, someone came up with the idea that we should have individualized kurtas and shirts. And then you had to write with black magic marker, KD, KKD, Krishna Kirtan Das. So on the back of your neck and your kurta, you have these big black stains from magic marker, these felt tip pens. Because when you write on the shirt, when you write K, then it bleeds into the cloth. So it goes K and it's, all sloppy, KKD, Krishna Kirtan Das. So everybody would be walking down the street with their orange shirt and be big, this big black. People come up and say, what's that black stuff in the back of your shirt? Well, that's my signature. That's my autograph. So my clothes don't become mixed with HKD, Hare Krishna Das. So then we got our own individual clothes. It was like, army issue. Two kurtas and two dhotis. But still, when it came to the sock department, no one cared whose socks they wore, and no one even cared what color they wore. So it was famous in America that a devotee would wear one red sock and one green sock. And when even on the talk shows, they would talk about the Hare Krishnas. They say, listen, if you want, listen everybody, this is Johnny Carson and these kind of talk show guys on the TV. So listen, if you want to catch the latest fashions, you have to go down to your Hare Krishna temple. The latest thing in New York now is mismatched socks. Wear a red sock on one foot and a green sock on the other foot. Because, devotees didn't care. So they got an Hari Nam with one blue sock and one red sock. Or one white sock, one green sock. So I don't know whether they have Ruchi and Nam, or whether they were just absent-minded or something. So it says that one becomes detached from worldly matters when he remembers Bhagavan's name with a steady mind. So this Nishta and Ruchi, which comes, one becomes, he's getting a taste for Nam. So he's not even concerned about filling his belly or decorating his body. And then he cites verse 8, which is also from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, where Rupa Goswami is quoting Padma Puran to show one of the symptoms of Ruchi is he's never disturbed. Shoka marsh adibir bhaver akrantam yasya manasam katam tatra mukundasya spurti sambhavana bhavet. How can Mukunda manifest in the heart of a person who is filled with lamentation, anger, and so forth? Spurti sambhavana. Sambhavana bhavet. How can it happen? The spurti means a vision of Mukunda. Akrantam manasam. The mind is disturbed, and shoka means lamentation. Mukunda never manifests in a heart that becomes agitated by pleasure upon obtaining something temporary, or a mind that becomes distressed upon losing it. In this way, the living entity remains oblivious to Bhagavan. One should follow the character of Mahaprabhu's devotees and, guided by their mood, remain peaceful and steady in every situation. We should follow the example of Srivas Pandit. This is the ultimate in steadiness. This is a famous story about Srivas Pandit. Once there was a kirtan going on inside his house. Mahaprabhu was there, Nityananda, Advaita, and everyone was dancing in Srivas Angam. Angam means an attached area, like limb. Angam means limb, arm or body. So the attached area, the courtyard, which is an attachment to the house. They're in the courtyard of the compound of Srivas Thakur, dancing in euphoria under the moonlight. And inside the house, the ladies were watching the kirtan, and they were also chanting among themselves. And in the midst of this kirtan, Shivananda's saint son, he left his body. Srivas Thakur's son left his body. But Srivas Pandit, he remained calm, and he strictly forbade the ladies and other persons in the house from crying. Because what happened was that his son died and they were all chanting, and then someone came out and whispered in Srivas Pandit's ear, "Excuse me, Panditji, your son has just died." He said, "Really?" And then he went inside the house. Everyone's crying because his son died. Naturally, everyone would cry, especially the mother and relatives. And then Srivas Pandit went in and said, "What happened?" They said, "Your son cried." He said, "Well, that's very bad. Anyone, everyone be quiet." Be quiet. And you can imagine, because maybe you can't imagine, but in a village, because I lived in a village for some time here, in a village, if someone dies next door, some old lady or old man, the ladies in the village, they cry for 1 month. 1 month. They cry continuously like karori birds crying in the night. They cry all for like 1 or 2 days without stop. And then they kind of, that's loud crying, wailing. And then they just kind of continue to whimper. And then if someone comes, if they hear the news that so-and-so has died, one of the relatives, senior members of the Parivar family, then someone comes from Kamyavan, one relative, to pay their respects to the deceased. Then they meet that wife of that dead husband. then when that wife meets her cousin's sister, then she again, ah! You know, then the crying goes up, and then they both cry for another 12 hours. Because this happened in the neighborhood. And I asked what's going on, and it was like a one-week crying festival. You know, like intense for 1 week, and then it went on for 1 month. Then someone came 2 weeks later to console the wife, and then they would say, "Oh, it's very bad, your husband died." And she said, "Oh, yeah, my husband, ah!" It's like unbelievable, really unbelievable. Because in the West, someone, you know, gets the news, they call and say, "Oh, your husband died in an auto wreck. Oh, that's too bad." Anyway, I mean, no one even cries, you know. They just say, "Oh, God, where's his will, you know? Do you have a copy of his will?" And no one cries, like, for 5 seconds. Rather, they're happy. "Oh, he finally died. Great. I've been waiting to get the house and money all this time anyway." So now, thinking of that, about this village situation, now Srivas Thakur, this is just a minute after the son has died, he goes in and says, "Listen, chup karo, stop. Stop crying." And they're about to cry for 1 month. They're all worked up and emotionally disturbed, ready to cry for 1 month. And he comes in and says, "Look, stop crying. You're going to interrupt. You're going to disturb Mahaprabhu's kirtan. He's absorbed in his ecstasies, and now you're going to disturb him." Wah, wah, wah. So for 1 second they kept quiet, then he left, and they probably started. So when he went back, Srivas Thakur, he did not even relate the news of his son's death to Mahaprabhu. His mind was so fixed and peaceful, with such a fixed and peaceful mind, one should remember and meditate upon Bhagavan. This is the purport of the Shastra. So this verse is saying that no matter what happens to us, so much distress may happen, we should keep a very peaceful mind. And that's only possible by taking shelter of the holy name. Because when the mind becomes disturbed by various situations, then agitated, if it does, then the holy name is our only recourse. And we find anyone's had the experience and they're facing serious problems in life, emotional or mental problems or physical or spiritual or any kind of problems, if they actually sit down and chant the holy name for many, many hours, how much nice experience they have. That Sri Namprabhu comes to comfort you and come to relieve you of distress. There's actually great magic in Krishna's name, which everyone sitting here must have experienced. And if you haven't, then try it out for a long time. If you face any difficulty, go away somewhere in a lonely place or find some secluded area where no one will disturb you and give your cell phone to someone else. Turn off your cell phone for 1 month or say, "Hold my cell phone. I'm doing a phone brut. Because in previous ages, I used to do mon brut. Mon means silence. But now they do phone brut. Phone brut means that you turn off your cell phone and you take a 7-day phone brut. Or if that's too austere, try to take a 1-day phone brut. Like people ask me sometimes, I used to do mon brut also sometimes, a few times I've done, which is also very good. But I tell some people, they say, "I was trying to call you for 2 weeks." And I said, "Well, I was doing a phone brut." You know, turn off my phone for 2 weeks. It's actually very nice. So that's this verse. Now this is a very interesting verse these are all verses about ruchi. And this verse indicates three symptoms of ruchi, or how to recognize one's spiritual advancement. This is a very, very important verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, and the teachings of the King Nimi and the Navi Ogendras. It's 11th canto, chapter 2, verse 42. Bhakti pareshanu bhavo viraktir anyatra chesha trika eka kalaha prapadyamanasya yatashnatasyus tushti pushti shudapayonu kasam. With each morsel of food that a hungry person eats, he simultaneously experiences satisfaction, nourishment and relief from hunger. In other words, when you eat, It's not that you just feel satisfied. Oh, I feel happy. I ate, I feel good. I'm happy. But also that food will be turned into blood and bones and skin, and it will nourish your body. It will give you strength and maintain your body. So that happens, although that's rather unknown to us, or that's an unconscious experience, but that goes on, definitely. And then the other thing is relief from hunger. So being satisfied means that before you're unsatisfied, and you're unsatisfied because of the hunger. So food, you feel, it takes away the hunger, and if you all, and when your hunger is completely removed, which is one symptom of eating, one result of eating, the second result is you're satisfied. And the third result, which is rather intangible or imperceivable, is that you get nourished. So there's three results of eating. So this is the comparison. Similarly, a surrendered devotee who is engaged in performing bhakti, he simultaneously realizes his worshipable deity. He strengthens his relationship with that deity, and he becomes detached from the temporary world and material relationships. So it says tushti, pushti, and apayonugasam. So pushti means nourishment, tushti means satisfaction. That's for eating. And it says bhakti presh anubhava virakti. So we get devotion, and then anubhavs, different ecstasies come, and we get detachment, virakti. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he's put this verse into Bengali. Bhakta jani samamane yuga parudai bhakti jnana virakti tina janaha nishchay chirasid ishvara sambandh chirachid ishvara sambandha jnane jnan krishnetare anasakti virakti praman je rupa bhajane tushti pushti pratigras shudara nivrittiye tina anayas. He says, upon attaining ruchi, one experiences simultaneously the manifestation of devotional feelings. Then he gets knowledge of matter, spirit, and God, and an understanding of Krishna's essential nature, and a taste of Krishna's sweetness. It's called anubhav. Then three, he gets a sense of detachment from his material possessions and relations, and develops a feeling of indifference to anything other than Krishna. This is very common. Even, as I said, drops of ruchi sprinkle down all the way to anartha nivritti. It's like when the rain falls. If you go outside and out in the open, then the full rain falls on your head. But if you go under a tree, then only a few drops may filter through the leaves. Like this. So even at the state of ruchi, then when you're at that state, then the rain is really covering you. But even at the state of anartha nivritti, a few drops come. Especially this indifference to anything other than Krishna. This is the first one thing that people see when a devotee becomes interested in Krishna or practicing bhakti. The parents often remark, how is it you're becoming indifferent? The things that you once liked so dearly, had so much taste for, now you're indifferent. You used to like so much to go play cricket or watch cricket on the television. And now when your friends invite you for cricket, you say, I don't feel like it. I'd rather read or chant or go to the temple. Or some match comes on the television and your father says, oh, sit down and watch. You say, I don't want. Hey, what's with you? Are you going crazy? You say, no, I lost my taste. So this is a type of indifference. So this comes even in the beginning. So we can recognize our spiritual advancement, to what extent we have these experiences. How much this indicates how much ruchi is coming. The symptoms observed in the sadhaka who has directly experienced the sweetness of Bhagavan are described in this text. In such devotees, three symptoms are simultaneously visible: attaining the service of the Lord, realization of knowledge related to bhakti, and detachment from matters unrelated to Krishna. The sadhaka develops detachment from those items of enjoyment that are not useful in the service of Krishna. But he does not develop detachment from that which can be used in Krishna's service. Because he does not consider using such objects for his own pleasure, there's no need for him to renounce them. And we realize that everything can be used for Krishna's pleasure. And there's an example given here that Because of humility, Sanatan Goswami wanted to throw his body under Jagannath's cart and give it up because it was infected with disease and he thought it was unsuitable to present before Lord Chaitanya. So he said, since my body cannot be offered to Lord Chaitanya, I should throw it away, should give it up under the cart. Gaura Sundar, he was in everyone's heart as a super soul, he told them that no one can attain Krishna by suicide. Krishna is only attained through bhajan. That is, by fulfilling the inner desire of one's guru, manobishta seva, by serving the heart's desire of the guru. When the sadhaka surrenders to Sri Guru's lotus feet, the guru becomes the owner of the sadhaka's body. When one acknowledges his body to be his guru's property, it is necessary to take care of it. It's like people, non-devotees also sleep, but we just say they're sleeping to regain their physical strength to engage in maya service. But devotees also sleep, but our sleeping is bhakti, it's devotion. It's also bhakti. Because why are we sleeping? We're sleeping just enough to nourish and revitalize the body so we can utilize this body in Krishna's service, or more immediately, in Guru's service, which is also Krishna's service. So therefore, we're sleeping and non-devotees are sleeping, but our sleeping is bhakti. It's devotional service because we realize that our body belongs to Krishna and Guru and we're trying to offer it for His pleasure. So we're sleeping because the body requires some sleep. So whatever we require and nothing more, we accept it. Okay, this is my service. So usually we dive right into it. We dive right into that service. Oh, now it's time for my sleeping service. Oh boy, like eating service and sleeping service. Eating is also prasad seva. We take prasad and we remember the Lord. And different levels we remember. In the beginning we remember, oh Krishna, you're so kind, you gave me 56 preparations for lunch. That's also remembering the Lord. And later on you may remember, or at least you can remember. How can we say we can experience what Lord Chaitanya is experiencing? But we may remember when we take prasadam, we may remember Lord Chaitanya remembering the taste of Krishna's lips in the mood of Radhabhav, because that's described in Antilila. So we may imagine, or at least think, wow, when Lord Chaitanya is in Puri and he takes Krishna's prasadam, he tastes the nectar of Krishna's lips. I can't say I'm exactly tasting the nectar of Krishna's lips, but at least I'm appreciating that taste is here. And maybe someday by Gaura's mercy, maybe I also taste that transcendental nectar of Krishna's lips. And so our mind is going in a very high thought and remembering the intimate leelas of Krishna or Gauranga, and Gauranga is remembering the intimate leelas of Radharani and Krishna. So in this way, our eating becomes much less also, because our mind becomes so absorbed in these deeper, higher thoughts that we only eat a small amount and we feel very satisfied. So that's why you see the advanced devotees like Srila Prabhupada. When I was in Los Angeles, they would bring these big silver trays of bhog for Prabhupada's lunch. And so many preparations. I mean, one time, Prabhupada went in the kitchen and there were so many pots and cakes and cookies. And then all these ladies and gentlemen, devotees were cooking, men and lady devotees. And Prabhupada said, it was a very appropriate remark. He said, are you cooking for me? Or are you cooking for you? Because when Prabhupada would eat, all this big tray would come out with so many varieties of tasty, delicious things. He would take a little chapati, a little dal, a little sabji, a little eggplant, like this fried eggplant, which he liked a lot. I think they call it eggplant puki or something like that. He always took a little bit of that and sometimes a little pakora. And that's about it. Not much else, because we saw sometimes, because they bring the plate to the Sankirtan room, or they bring the Mahaprasadam for the Sankirtan devotees. Anyway, everything, only a few little things would be touched by Prabhupada. So he didn't eat all that much, but he certainly served with tremendous energy. And it took him a long time to Prabhupada to eat. You can read in Leelamrita, Prabhupada spent like 30 minutes taking his prasadam. He didn't eat anything. It was just like one bite and he was absorbed in his meditation. We eat like 5 kilos in 10 minutes. Prabhupada ate like 50 grams in 45 minutes. And very slowly eating. And you can see the picture at Radha Damodar. that we used to worship when we stayed over there. And Prabhupada's sitting at his chokhi, little desk, and he's taking his prasad and he's looking out. Of course, this was during ISKCON time. But he's looking out the window, which he also did when he lived there, but he probably didn't have a chokhi at that time. He would eat on the floor, a small leaf plate or something, some plate. But he would look out the window, and he would take his prasad, and he would look out the window at Rupa Goswami's samadhi and be lost in different deep meditations about Rupa Mundri and Rupa Goswami. So Prabhupada's eating was a meditation. And so we're just saying like this, that the devotee becomes a property of the guru. When one acknowledges his body to be his guru's property, it is necessary to take care of it. In the same mood, the Braja Devis decorate their bodies with clothes, ornaments, cosmetics, and so forth, only for the service to Krishna. That's quite a quantum leap there, that we're sleeping on the floor of the Brahmacharya ashram, and sleeping as service to Krishna, and our bodies are being engaged in service of Krishna. And now we're going from there all the way to the gopis. When they're dressing in the morning, when the mantris dress Radharani and the sakis, they dress her and ornament her very beautifully, and then one gopi holds a mirror before Radharani. And as soon as she sees the mirror, sees her reflection in the mirror, Srimati Radhika, she doesn't even think for one ten-thousandth of a second. She doesn't even think for one-tenth, when she sees her image, she doesn't even think for one-ten-thousandth of a second, oh, I look beautiful. Because this is the idea. If someone looks in the mirror, they think, oh, I look beautiful. I'm dressing up just to accompany my husband and I hope he's happy with my beauty or whatever. As soon as Radharani sees her reflection in the mirror, she says, take me. Rush me to Nandagaon. Don't hesitate. Immediately, let's fly as fast as a jet plane, go to Nandagaon. Because everything is perfectly in place. Every hair on my head, every curl on my forehead, and this curl and that curl, and the pearls, everything is perfectly straight and looking so beautiful. I want to be whisked away immediately to Nandagaon. So within the next second, this perfectional presentation of your dressing and my beauty can be offered to Krishna. This is her thinking. So, because what is she thinking? Radharani's thinking, my body belongs to Krishna. I remember in San Francisco, the karmis would buy these t-shirts, and it would be a gray-colored t-shirt, and it would say, Property of San Quentin. San Quentin is a prison where prisoners, murderers, and these kind of guys go there. So when you go there, they give you clothes, but they belong to the government. So when you leave there, if you only stay for a month, they take your clothes back. And then I don't know how you walk out of there, but but anyway, the clothes say they're it's stamped on there. It's painted with a stencil. They put a stencil on the shirt and they paint it. In other words, this clothing is a property of the prison, like government property. So the devotee feels like that, property of Sri Guru. And even they write sometimes the Bengali, in Bengali Vaishnavas as one of their principles of smaranam, or it's kind of a principle of devotional ego, that they write on their body. They take Radhakund Tilak or any Tilak, and they write Sri Radha, or they write Sri Guru, or Nitai Gaur. Like this, they write on their chest, because this is our heart is here, and it's a rather large area to write on. So they write like this. And so the idea is property of Sri Radha, just like property of San Quentin. So anyone sees them, they'll be reminded of Radha. It's a little tricky, actually, because when you're writing, you're looking down like upside down, So sometimes you look, they write upside down. I've seen sometimes they're writing and the letters are from where they're looking, they're writing it as if they're looking. So the letter, you have to write it as if someone else is reading it. Because we've done it a few times. And I was trying to write in Bengali, Sri Radha, and I was writing it from up here down here, but when someone outside looks at it, it's upside down. because I was going like this and Sri, then Radha. But you have to, it takes a little, I have to write it as it, or have someone else write it on your back. And you also get stamps, you can get these stamps. I got these stamps made once in Lakriwood. It said Radhe Sham, and I got one for myself and one for Indra. little stents, and we would put in tilak and put it on our forehead, Radhe Shyam. And he still has it, and he puts it on his forehead sometimes, Radhe Shyam. Because our bodies belong to Guru and Krishna. So when we're thinking like that, or we're trying to think like that, and trying to act like that, and the gopis themselves, they also think that their bodies, they act in fully in the mood that their bodies belong to Krishna. Now this concept of indifference to material objects develops according to the extent of one's realization of Bhagavan. This indifference to material objects gives one the qualification to attain the direct service of Bhagavan. So I thought we could look in the Bhagavatam itself at this verse, because it's such an important verse. And there's some quotations here in the purport about this bhakti pareshana bhava viraktir. Anyatra chesha trika ekakalaha prapadyamanasya yatashnatasyus tushti pushti shut apayonagasam. Jiva Goswami has explained this analogy as follows. Bhakti or devotion may be compared to tushti, because these words are there. When they talk about the food, they say tushti pushti shudapayo, that it gives tushti, which means satisfaction, and pushti, like pushti marg. The Vallabhacharya is called pushti marg, or pushti marg means the path of nourishment. Or sometimes they say that's their path of rag bhakti, or raganuga is pushti marg. But pushti means food gives nourishment, and tushti gives satisfaction. Like we say Santosh or Ashutosh. Lord Shiva's Ashutosh means easily satisfied. You must have heard this. So Tushti means satisfaction. Pushti, nourishment. Shutapayo means eradicating hunger. So now each of these words, like bhakti equals Tushti. So bhakti or devotion may be compared to Tushti, satisfaction, because they both take the form of pleasure. Parish anubhava, anubhavs, which means experience of the Supreme Lord, and pushti, nourishment, are similar, because both sustain one's life. So food nourishes us and sustains our life, and our spiritual life is sustained or nourished when we have experience of the Lord. If we don't experience Krishna, we can't go on. We die. We shrivel up. If we don't experience Krishna in our chanting, in our serving, in our praying, then we can't be inspired. We're only going forward because we're experiencing Krishna. And that experience is coming as inspiration, that taste, that reflection, that hope, that idea, that connection. We're individually experiencing it, and that's driving us forward. That's our pushti, that's our nourishment. Then finally, virakti. So what is virakti? Virakti means cessation of hunger. These two may be compared. When you eat, hunger goes away, and when you perform bhakti, when you come to the level of ruchi, then this detachment is there. Because detachment and cessation of hunger both are free one from further hankering, so that one may experience shanti or peace. So when you have no more hunger, then you feel peaceful. You're not hungry, you're not disturbed or agitated by hunger. Oh, yeah, I feel good, I'm full. So when bhakti comes, when you actually have this taste and devotion, then you feel this virakti, you feel detached, you feel peaceful. Then the very pleasant analogy of a good meal is given in this verse. A hungry man busily consuming a sumptuous plate of food is not interested in anything else that's happening around him. When someone is very hungry and you give him a plate of food, he's just absorbed, eating, and so many things may be going around him, dogs barking or people shouting or saying anything. He doesn't even hear them, doesn't even notice it. So, in fact, this person, he considers any other topic or activity a disturbance to his concentration on a delicious meal. Just like, for example, if a man is in the desert, I've heard this analogy also given, if a man is in a desert and he's been stuck there for 7 days, and he's dying of thirst, and then a helicopter comes overhead, and then out of the helicopter comes a cable with a basket, and in that basket is Miss Universe, and the basket is lowered down on the cable, and that basket lands right in front of the man who's been sitting in a desert for 7 days, and this lady comes out and and makes all these provocative suggestions. And the guy says, you know, later, man, really, it's a great presentation, but I don't want it. I don't care. I want some water. You know, where ordinarily any man or woman would be interested in enjoying the opposite sex. This is a common feature of the material world. But in this situation, the only thing that matters, the only thing that he cares about is water. That's all that he wants. That's all that, because he's going to die if he doesn't get water. Even in the most, you know, so-called object of greatest pleasure in the material world is presented before him. He has absolutely no interest in it. So that's what he's saying here, that the hungry man, when he's eating a plate of food, he considers any other topic or activity a disturbance in his concentration on a delicious meal. As soon as one advances in Krishna consciousness, he considers anything unrelated to devotion an obnoxious disturbance. Such concentrated love of God is described in Bhagavatam, Tivrena Bhakti Yogena Yajeta Purusham Param. One should not make an artificial show of renouncing the world. One should systematically train the mind to see everything as an expansion of the opulence of the Lord. Just as a hungry materialistic man, upon seeing sumptuous food, immediately desires to put it in his mouth. Similarly, an advanced devotee of Krishna, upon seeing a material object, immediately becomes eager to use it for the pleasure of Krishna. Without the spontaneous hunger to engage everything in the service of Krishna and to dive deeper and deeper into the ocean of love of God, so-called realization of God, or loose talk about so-called religious life is irrelevant to the actual experience of entering the kingdom of God. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that the path of bhakti yoga is so joyful and practical that even at the stage of sadhan bhakti, or vaidhi sadhana, rules and regulations, without an advanced understanding, one can perceive the ultimate result. In other words, even when one's practicing vaidhi sadhana, the result is that all these things come, satisfaction and peace of mind and devotion and actual experience of the Lord, direct experience. And these are written about. And as we're practicing sadhana, we get a glimmer of these things. We get some faint contact with these, and because of that contact with these future attainments, the attainments that one will attain as when they, the accomplishments that one gets when one advances in bhakti, one perceives a glimmer of them even at the level of sadhana. So then that inspires him to go forward. One can perceive the ultimate result. For example, it's nighttime, and as it gets closer to dawn, you can perceive, very soon the sun will be shining over my head with full intensity. But now it's only 28 degrees or it's 25 degrees, which only for Vrindavan it's only. It's quite cool. It's nighttime, and soon it'll be 45 degrees at midday in the summertime, 46 degrees it can be. But now it's only 22, 24 at night it can also be. So even in the beginning, in sadhana, we can perceive that, yes, these states will come, what we described. We can get some faint light of the future comes to us. And it's real. It's real. The dawn is real. We don't even see the sun, but we see light in the sky. And there's no stars or moon. They've already gone. But the light is coming from the aurora of the sun. The sun is about to rise, but already the light is coming. So the light of prema and the light of these ecstatic symptoms and the light of this peacefulness and detachment and experience of the Lord, it comes as a dawn, as a dawning, even in sadhana. Iha yasya harer dasye karmana manasagira nikalashvapi avashtasu jivan mukta suyuchate. As soon as one surrenders to Krishna, giving up all their activities, one is immediately considered liberated. Krishna is so merciful. When a living entity understands that Krishna is everything and he surrenders, Krishna personally takes charge of him and reveals to him within his heart that he is under the Lord's full protection. So that is individual. That this is because this verse is used by Acharyas to explain the sentence of Ruchi. Because this verse is cited by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. This is Ruchi, Nam Ruchi. He uses this in his presentation or his argument of Ruchi and Bhajan, that it brings these symptoms of bhakti, and he says, then virakti, bhakti, and direct experience, anubhav, bhakti parish anubhava viraktir, that devotion comes of experience of Krishna and also detachment from the world. So one of these things, this is Vishnu's commentary, Krishna, he understands when he surrenders that Krishna is everything, that Krishna is personally taking charge of me, and he's revealing to me within my heart that I am under his full protection. Thus, devotion, direct experience of the personality of Godhead, and detachment from other objects becomes manifest even in the beginning stage of Bhakti Yoga, since Bhakti Yoga begins at the point of liberation. Other processes have as their final goal salvation or liberation. But according to Gita, as soon as one surrenders, he's immediately liberated, and he begins his career as a transcendental devotee with complete confidence in the Lord's protection. So these experiences of ruchi, of course, they deepen and get more profound as one progresses to a sakti bhavan prema. Here we're having some experience of the Lord at this stage of ruchi. Yes, the Lord is my protector. Because this is Sharanagati, you surrender. One of the sentences of Sharanagati is Rakshishya Titi Vishwaso. Rakshishya Titi Vishwaso, that I have faith, and not only faith, but experience. At the beginning you have faith. Yes, I have faith. God is my protector. That's even at the beginning, Anartha Nivritti. When we come to Ruchi, we have direct experience. Yes, Krishna is protecting me, as he says. I am under the Lord's full protection. So this conviction and realization one gets at the stage of Ruchi. So this is what he's telling here. So that, and then it says that he reveals to him within his heart. So we get revelation. This is a revelation that the Lord is protecting me. He's in my heart. Then the revelations become deeper. Then it becomes spurti. And some, it's explained as spurti visporti and sakshat darshan. Spurti is like a vision where you're meditating on the Lord, and you actually have some vision of the Lord in your mind. It's a conscious effort. And visporti is an intensified vision that it is so intense that you feel like you're really not meditating, seeing the Lord in your mind or heart, but actually you're seeing the Lord. Because it goes on for sustained for some long time, visporti, extended sporti or extended vision. And it seems so real that you feel that you can actually touch the Lord. That's called visporti. But it's all happening inside, within the mind, within our meditation. Then sakshat darshan, that's outside. We open our eyes and Krishna gives us the eyes, because in material eyes you can't see Krishna. Krishna actually gives us the eyes by which we can see his transcendental form standing before us. And sometimes he may touch us, like he touched the cheek, the kapola sparsha. It says, chakra kapola sparsha. The Lord Vishnu touched the kapola, the cheek of Dhruva. And when he touched his cheek, then Dhruva started speaking. So there's different interactions that will happen with the Lord directly at the stage of sakshat darshan. Like Bilvamangala Thakur was having sakshat darshan of Krishna. Sometimes he was holding his hand, grabbing his hand, and playing with him, and then throwing his hand away. And Bilvamangala Thakur, he was saying, hey, little boy, hey, Gopal. And then Gopal would grab him and say, hey, old man, try to catch me. And then he would hold on to him. And then Gopal would throw his hand away. He says, oh, you can't catch me. Then he wrote this verse in Krishna Karnamrita. He says, all right, Gopal, you can escape from my grasp. You can escape from my hands, but you can never escape from my heart. This is a famous verse in Krishna Karnamurta. So, in this way, this experience of the Lord is called Bhakti Paresh Anubhava Viraktir. Anubhav, this experience of the Lord, will get deeper and deeper and more profound as we advance in bhakti. In Spurti, Visporti, and Saksha Darshan, Spurti comes at the level, generally comes at the level of a Sakti. One can have Spurti, and at the level of Bhav, one can have Visporti. And generally, at the higher end of bhav or prem, then one gets sakshat darshan, may get sakshat darshan. So we'll stop there. If there's any questions, comments about ruchi. These are all verses from Bhajan Rahasyam, chapter 4. Yes.
As protector, or we chant even these kavachas and stuff for protection. So it usually refers to like protecting the body, but what about protecting the bhakti or protecting the consciousness? Or because you mentioned there, you see the Lord as our protector.
Yes.
But as I understand, like, you know, sometimes the body is destined to be broken or functional, but the main thing is that when Mahamaya catches us and then drags us, our consciousness, away from the Lord, then we need protection from that kind of.
I think protection is all on all sides. I mean, Prabhupada used to say that we should be afraid of Maya. We should fear Maya and pray for the Lord's protection from Maya, which manifests as illusion or distraction or while we're living. And there's not what Krishna wants to. We have the phrase in Hindi, Rake Krishna Mare Ke, Mare Krishna Rake Ke. If Krishna wants to protect me, no one can kill me. If Krishna wants to kill me, no one can protect me. And we mentioned this verse the other day from Gita when Krishna told Arjuna, Kaunteya pratijanihi na me bhakti pranashiti. He's saying that the bhakti, the pran, this is bhakti pran, nash, that declare boldly that my devotee never perishes. But literally the verse means that bhakti pran never perishes. The life, because the pran is the life force, and this bhakti pran actually means the spiritual life force, the life force of devotion. So whatever bhakti or devotional advancement that one has attained, that will be preserved and protected. Yoga kshemam mahamyaham. Yoga kshemam. Whatever yoga you've attained, whatever connection with God you've attained, that will be preserved. I preserve what you have and carry what you lack. Krishna says in the that verse, Anyavilashita, was it? You know that verse, Yoga Kshema Mahamyaham. What's that verse, the beginning? I forget. Can't remember it now. But it's, so this is the point, that Krishna actually protects the devotion. The body may go. He may take your body. You may have an old body, and he thinks this is a useless body, I'll give you a new body. Or he may have a young body, and he wants you to have a different body. So he takes away your young body, gives you a different body, but he continues your same level of devotion. He protects that. So devotees are more interested in praying for protection of that. Because the body, what can we do with that? That's up to the Lord. If he wants to maintain it and keep it, he'll keep it and maintain it. But we're more afraid of, like Prabhupada said, a devotee should be afraid of Maya, be afraid of forgetting the Lord and losing the association of the Lord. We're not so concerned about bodies. Will always be there. We'll always have a body. Body will always be there. Either we'll have siddhadeha, spiritual body in the spiritual world, or a body in this world. But what's really important, what we really should guard and be careful, is not to lose our spiritual consciousness by committing offenses or by giving up the Lord or exercising our independence to leave the Lord due to the attraction of Maya. So that we should always be praying for protection from that. Krishna, please protect my Krishna consciousness. Whatever consciousness I have of you, by your grace, please protect that. Don't let me lose that. This, I think, is the real ultimate meaning of protection. Yes? What can we do to prepare our bodies and minds so they are in the best condition for japa and meditation? Well, of course, if you approach these concepts of japa and meditation from the yogic viewpoint, or Patanjali Yoga Sutras, then there are so many mechanical and physical things that can be done to enhance the mode of goodness, to increase or enhance the mode of goodness within the body and mind, which will create a more conducive atmosphere for japa and meditation. But we are, as devotees, we're not so concerned by the auxiliary pursuits of yoga. What we're really concerned about is the change of consciousness, is trying to change our consciousness, and that can be done without any physical change. If you look at a great saint, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he didn't have the frame, he did not have the physical frame of the average yogi. He was quite heavy. His body was heavy. It was not the yogi type body. And he ate very sparingly. If you read his life history, he didn't eat very much. But his consciousness, he was absorbed in bhakti. So almost practically we don't have to do any, whatever body we have, we try to maintain it as best as possible. It's very hard to change the nature of the body. The body is constituted of the three modes and arranged in different ways. So we accept the body that we have, maintain it in a healthy position, and try to, as much as possible, through prayer, through prarthana, we try to create the environment we try to, moreover, work on changing our consciousness than changing our body and mind. Because there's so many physical things that one can do, but they may end up being pratikul to bhakti. That's happened in Los Angeles back in the 70s. Many devotees were saying, Prabhupada, this food in the temple is not healthy. And we want to eat health food. We want to eat sprouts and all these wheatgrass and all these kind of things. You know, Yadubar and a bunch of different devotees were involved in this sprout movement. Sprout, back to sprout head. And Prabhupada was saying, just take prasadam. Take, you know, because prasadam will give you love of Godhead. And prasadam will change your consciousness, because we have to put something in our body that's going to change our consciousness. And what's going to change our consciousness is association with Krishna. And Krishna doesn't eat sprouts. I mean, there's mention in Chaitanya Charitamrita, one of the things they're offering in a big feast to Lord Chaitanya, I think at Vaitacharya's house, it did mention mung bean sprouts. I saw it there. It says mung sprouts. So there's some mention, but it didn't say wheatgrass.